significant one that suggests where we were going with this in Section 2, Subsection 7 on page 3 of the bill. In the original version, it said that the Department of Forestry could not impose or require standards more strict than those found in the Forest Practices Act. We took testimony in the House Revenue Committee and heard that, in fact, private landowners do manage their lands, sometimes in excess of the bare minimum requirements of the Forest Practices Act. They may leave broader stream buffers than are strictly required. They may plant, they may replant more intensively than might be required under the Forest Practices Act. And so making clear that we did not intend to hamstring the Department of Forestry to a literal application in every respect of each of the provisions of the Forest Practices Act, we took that language out. The Department of Forestry would still have the same flexibility in managing these state lands as private landowners do in managing private forest lands in this state. And finally, I think what I would say is that this bill really suggests that the Forest Practices Act that governs the management of about 15 million acres of private forest land in this state really does represent a template that is suitable for use by the state in managing these lands, which historically came to the state as industrial lands. And that the question, should the state have a different standard for managing its state forest lands, is not one that necessarily presupposes an answer in the negative. That the Forest Practices Act has worked well for the years that it has been in place for private forest lands. If it needs to be strengthened, well, then that's the place we go. I don't think we need to create a different standard for these state lands, especially in the context that they do represent less than 3% of the forest land in this state. 15 million acres in private land hands and more than 50% in federal hands that are already essentially locked away from this kind of timber harvest activity that can provide jobs. We have this opportunity in this bill, I think, to do one of the most significant economic revitalization efforts of this session, to create jobs, create revenue to our counties, and revitalize some portions of the state that really are in desperate need of this kind of economic activity, while still respecting the environmental laws that apply from the federal level and, frankly, from the state level. We're not changing state environmental laws with this either. So I think it's a balanced bill, and I thank you again for the opportunity to appear before you, and I urge your support for House Bill 5632.
Thank you, Representative Shetterly. I appreciate you bringing this bill to us. It's been a struggle for me in the years that I've been here, when we, especially now in this time when we need more money for schools. And I say we have more money for schools, we're just choosing to burn it up. So I appreciate you bringing this bill, and hopefully we can move it through this committee. Any questions for Representative Shetterly? Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I may, just, you did mention money. I do want to emphasize, too, that if you look at the revenue impact, at least as it came out of the House, we don't anticipate money for this biennium. This is not a cut-and-run proposal. This is really a move to long-term and sustainable harvest and revenue. Frankly, I think that there's ways that we should be able to get revenue in from this, but we're not counting on this. This is not a quick fix for some short-term budget problem. We really are looking at this as at rebalancing the pendulum of our economic base here in Oregon, and recognizing that we need to put some more and greater emphasis back on the natural resource base that historically was an important part of our economic base here in Oregon.
Yeah. Well, in the very fact you're talking about 4,300 jobs, when I sat in Ag Committee like this in 1989, and the economists were saying that we would get rid of 15,000 jobs with the changes we were making in the timber industry, it would be nice to have 4,300 of those jobs returned. Senator Burdick?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The timber that's damaged by the Swiss needle cast disease, is that usable timber?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, yes. I think what you'll hear from the certified smart people that will follow is really what the Swiss needle cast disease, what that is it inhibits the growth of the timber. That is, it stops its growth, and so it becomes non-productive. These trees otherwise are just as good as any other growing trees. It's just that if you get a forest that is infested with the Swiss needle cast disease, it just quits growing or begins to grow. You just get much less growth. And so the objective is to move those trees out and replace them with trees that are not susceptible to the Swiss needle cast, so you get that kind of sustainable yield.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chairman. I certainly concur that change needs to be made, but I was curious as to why I would much prefer a provision in this bill that said if they were going to harvest those trees, that it would count toward the amount of timber harvest they're able to get out of the forest. I don't see the rationale for not counting that toward the harvest.
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, frankly, I wasn't certainly our intent to exclude that from the count. I think the revenue impact statement is predicated, again, that came from the Department of Forestry ultimately, and I would assume that it contemplates the harvest of the Swiss needle cast affected trees probably more intensively at the front end. So I think they do very much count toward the revenue impact statement that you see with the bill.
The revenue impact, but in section 1 on page 2, line 18 through 21, it says that they need to get them out as rapidly as possible without reducing management and harvest activities in other portions of the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forest. So, they front-end load, and then they can just keep harvesting at regular levels throughout the forest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Burdick, I guess still in mind, though, that when you overlay the Forest Practices Act on top of this, you are still going to be limited to what is a sustainable harvest. No matter what you front-end load, you are still going to have to, your harvest is going to be limited by the sustainability that's required under the Forest Practices Act. That's probably a better question for some of the folks who'd follow after me.
Thank you.
Madam Chair. Senator Brown.
Representative Shetterly, a couple questions, and I know nothing about this issue, and or am only learning bits and pieces, so I'm probably very dangerous. The Forest Practices Act governs private land. Basically, you would say you would put the Tillamook and the Clatsop forests under the same management plan as you would put under private lands. But I'm assuming under private lands you're assuming that there's no public benefit or public benefit derived from the use on those private lands. So why would you put public lands under a similar management policy of private when I presume there's other public benefits to the forest?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Brown. First of all, I think we did hear testimony, and I hope you will hear today, that to place these lands under this more intensive harvest regimen does not exclude other public uses and benefits. You're still going to be able to accommodate other public benefits, so these forests will not be closed off to all other public uses and purposes and benefits. Also, though, I think you have to keep in mind the history of these lands. These did come to the state following the, we're speaking here mostly of the Tillamook and Clatsop forests, following the Depression and the Tillamook burn. These were industrial lands when they were when they came to the state. They were conveyed to the state by the counties for management, and historically that was the pattern in which these lands were managed. And then I guess in terms of public use, it's I think also worthwhile to look at the broader context of all forest land in this state, recognizing again that more than 50% of the forest lands in the state are federal lands and very much available for a wide array of public uses, almost unfettered and unobstructed by any kind of harvest activity. So I think if you look at these as a small mix of all of those broader lands and the benefit that we can derive from the increased harvest activity, I think it makes sense to achieve the balance that we achieved here in House Bill 3632.
Madam Chair. Senator Brown.
Did I hear you say that our state forests have been neglected?
Madam Chair, no, I think, okay. No, thank you, and that's a good question. I think what I said was, it was the industry, really, that has, I think, suffered benign neglect over the past 15 to 20 years. We have lost, I think, more than 100 mills in the past 10 years, I believe you get testimony of that, thousands of jobs out of the forests, and really there's not much that we have done to try to reinvigorate the timber industry as that has been happening. I think in some respects we've sort of thrown up our hands to the limitations that have been imposed, especially on the federal forests, and not really been very attentive to the additional benefits, economic benefits that we could derive from these state forest lands. But also, these are forest lands that are just now, in the past few years, coming into rotation for this kind of harvest and to begin this kind of sustainable harvest. And so it's worthwhile looking at them. But I thank you for letting me clarify that, because that was not my intent to say that the state forest lands have been neglected. They've not been. They've been managed well. I think we as a legislature and as a state have neglected our forest industry over those years, and not our forests.
Thank you, Representative Shetterly. Any further questions? Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Next, we'll hear from the representatives from the Department of Forestry. Gentlemen.
Chair Kleiner, members of the committee, I'd like to have Ross Holloway and Charlie Stone with me to provide a testimony.
Yes, I do have two pages of sign-ups, so any groups that can come together, that would be great.
Chair Kleiner, members of the committee, my name is Steve Thomas, Assistant State Forester for the Department of Forestry. I appreciate the opportunity to present the department's testimony regarding House Bill 3632. As I mentioned previously, I have Ross Holloway, who is the State Forest Program Director, with me, and also Charlie Stone, Assistant State Forester for the Protection Division. And they both will share some perspectives from a little bit different viewpoints regarding House Bill 3632. We look forward to answering any questions you may have, in addition, to provide you with any additional information that you may need to make this deliberation. We have made presentations to several committees already for the legislature and provided a bulk of information. We're going to save a lot of that from you at this point in time and try to hit some highlights. So with that, I'll turn it over to Ross.
Okay, thank you. For the record, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ross Holloway, and I'm the Director of the State Forest Program for the Department of Forestry. And as Steve said, we have testified before several other committees in the House and the Senate this session regarding state forest management. So our intent today is not to repeat all of that, but maybe just highlight some concerns that we still have with this bill in its current form. And the department does still oppose the bill in its current form, and that's because of its far-reaching effects on the forest management plans that we've developed and the board has adopted. And these are in the third year of implementation now on about 650,000 acres of state forests. And this ranges from our Sun Pass Forest in Klamath County to the Santiam Forest in the Cascades and then to the Clatsop and Tillamook State Forest on the North Coast, which, of course, are the largest forests affected. Rather than reiterate earlier testimony to the legislature, I'd like to focus really on kind of three things. One is what kind of outputs are being achieved under the current forest plan as it's being implemented. We want to talk about some projects we have underway to address some of the specific concerns that I believe lie at the heart of the concerns that prompted this legislation and that the supporters share. And then we want to talk about some broader scale policy implications that we see in the legislation, primarily related to how our plans interact with the State Forest Practices Act. The bill in its current form would require reconsideration and significant amendments to all of the forest management plans for Board of Forestry lands. And again, that's essentially three forest management plans, our Northwest Oregon plan, our plan for our Southwest Oregon State Forests, and our plan for our Eastern Region, which includes Sun Pass Forest in Clatsop County. And essentially this is because all of those plans contain some specific standards that do exceed the forest practices standards. And my reading of the bill is it would prohibit the board from establishing those higher standards, even though it would allow us on a site-by-site basis to exceed specific forest practice standards, as any private landowner could do. The forests most significantly affected are the Clatsop and the Tillamook, just because of their size and the age of the forests and the scale of operations underway there. The system that we have in place now, which we refer to as an integrated forest management system, has led to significant increases in all the outputs from the forest, not just economic, but also social and environmental resource outputs. And you'll find attached to your written testimony a brief paper that sort of highlights some of the accomplishments and outputs from the Tillamook Forest in recent years. Timber harvesting from the Clatskanie Tillamook has increased about twofold in the last 10 years and about 30% since the current forest management plan was adopted and implemented. And much of that increase is a result of hard work with the counties to address issues over harvest level concerns that's taken place since the plan was adopted. Concurrent with those increased harvest levels, we've made significant investments in recreational facilities under the recreation plans for the Tillamook and Clatskanie, including campgrounds, trails, and trailheads, and also day use areas. We've developed and expanded our forest education and interpretive programs on those forests. And we've made significant investments in projects related to water quality and fisheries habitat, ranging from road improvements to habitat restoration and enhancement projects. So all of this is going on at the same time out there on the forest. We believe the current forest management plan is producing a balance of these resource outputs and at very significant levels. We also believe there's a good potential for increased outputs in the future in all three areas, not just timber harvest, but also the recreational development aspects and some of the environmental outputs as well. But we believe that has to occur with careful and credible analysis, which is underway. We have a couple of specific projects already underway to address some of the concerns that have been raised over harvest levels. The most significant of these is a work plan that we're carrying out in cooperation with the counties to improve the harvest schedule model associated with the original forest planning work and to make changes in the harvest levels based on the results of that work. And it's intended to direct many of the questions and concerns about harvest levels on these lands through a collaborative analytical approach. And the counties are directly supporting this effort by participating both in our policy review team that's in place and has also assigned staff to the technical working group for this project. In fact, I've hired a private consultant to work with us on this project. And these are exactly the types of projects and change that was anticipated by the forest management plan. And in fact, the board adopted several specific strategies in the plan to accommodate these kinds of concerns and new information as they arose. The plan calls for a comprehensive review every 10 years, so notwithstanding some of these interim efforts to address concerns, at least every 10 years there's a complete review of the plan strategies and appropriate changes made. A few more points, and then I'll turn it over to Charlie Stone to talk about some of the other policy implications. Essentially, the bill as written would redefine the term greatest permanent value, and I think that kind of goes to the heart of what we would then be faced with, and that would be amending our existing forest management plans, which are based on the current definition found in administrative rule, and would also require the board to rescind or amend its administrative rules on state forest management, which currently include that definition of greatest permanent value. And I believe the handout attached to your information there today has that definition in it, so you can see how that reads. There have been claims that the legislation would only adjust the current management plan, but we don't agree with that assessment because of what I just stated about the foundation being the current definition of greatest permanent value. We believe we would have to redo those forest management plans through a public process, which would be time-consuming. The bill would require the department to manage these forests on a shorter rotation, more of a production model, similar to private industrial lands, and I think everybody's aware of that. And that was the basis for the fiscal impact analysis that we produced, was modeling we had done of a shorter rotation approach as part of the original modeling we did for the plan. Lastly, I just would say that several of the core strategies in the current forest management plan are critical elements of a proposed habitat conservation plan for these lands, a plan that would bring certainty and stability to what is right now a very difficult process of trying to find appropriate timber sales, survey them for T&E species, and then proceed with some legal certainty and business certainty with those sales. And this bill would change several of those key strategies in significant ways and would, I think, require us to start over on that process of trying to negotiate an acceptable HCP. With that, I'll turn it over to Charlie Stone to talk about some of the other policy implications more related to forest practices.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Madam Co-Chair, for the record, my name is Charlie Stone. I'm an Assistant State Forester for Protection with the Department of Forestry. Some may be wondering, what's the protection guy doing here today? And it's not my intention to talk about the forest management plan or the whether it's right to cut more timber or create more jobs and that type of thing on the forest. It's more to look at the co-mingling in this bill of concepts of directing the management of the state forest and tying that in with the Forest Practices Act, which I've been working with for the past 25-plus years. The state forests have always been required to comply with the Forest Practices Act. All the forests in the state have to meet the Forest Practices Act as minimum requirements. But this bill, on the one hand, the bill's not entirely specific. It could be read almost to say comply with the Forest Practices Act, and that's already the case. But I think clearly, as the other folks have said, that the implications of the bill are to not manage the forest in any way substantially beyond the requirements of the Forest Practices Act, particularly when it comes to forest structures and that type of thing. And that type of direction, I think, not because of what they're trying to direct, but is problematic from the structure of the Forest Practices Act. The Forest Practices Act is a set of minimum requirements. It's originally designed and primarily aimed at private forest land to ensure the continuous growing and harvesting and that private forest lands remain in productive state for the benefit of the state. And in order to do that, it sets minimums and says that we've got to satisfy certain requirements and concerns, protecting water quality, maintaining fish and wildlife, etc. And it sets those limitations. This appears to now set it also as a ceiling rather than, you know, it's a floor for private lands. It appears to be both a floor and a ceiling for the state forest management as this bill is constructed.
Senator Brown.
Can I sort of stop you right there? This all sort of sounds like gobbledygook to me. And just sort of let me tell you my perspective. I live in southeast Portland, so I'll give you that. But I have Representative Shetterly, who says this bill will create 43, based on your numbers, the numbers of your department, saying this will create 4,300 jobs. It will bring in $125 million of biennium, starting next biennium. So our schools are starving. We've got the highest unemployment, or not, if not the highest, one of the highest unemployment rates in the nation. So I appreciate the theoretical concepts that you're giving us, but can you talk to me in more practical? I mean, what the hell difference is it going to make if we pass this bill in terms of on the ground, how it will benefit or be detrimental to Oregonians? That would be helpful to me if you can sort of change the context a little bit.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Brown, I think that you'll hear in a moment, hopefully, from Board of Forestry Chair Howard Song, and he's going to talk some about having gotten the message and the fact that that there can be more jobs, more production off the forest. What I'm getting at here and was about to get to is the idea that by setting requirements that the state forest lands not be managed beyond the Forest Practices Act, but then recognizing that the state forest lands, in fact, must meet several other laws, Federal Endangered Species Act, cultural and archaeological requirements, scenic waterways, then that begs the question, does the Forest Practices Act need to be adjusted in order to fit those concepts and conform to what's required on state forest management as well? And we believe that the Forest Practices Act works well for the management of private lands. There are different segments, different pieces of the landscape that are going to produce different benefits. We don't regulate urban areas or agriculture in the same fashion that we do private forest lands because of practical considerations, and we don't manage the state forest lands the same as the private forest lands, and there are other places in the law that require those distinctions. And so a concern here is that the Forest Practices Act, by changing the management of the state forest land to say that it's going to be conforming to certain requirements as a ceiling under the Forest Practices Act, may very well create an entirely new push to do things differently in the Forest Practices Act when we don't feel that's necessary to meet its purposes on private land.
Excuse me, did I just hear you say that you are more restrictive in the management of private lands than you are the state land?
Madam Chair, no, I did not intend to say that. The The Forest Practices Act only covers certain areas, and there are other laws that all landowners, including state forests, must also comply with, but they're not addressed in the Forest Practices Act. If we're saying that the state forest can only do what's in the Forest Practices Act, and there's a bit of a logic stretch here, I admit, but the question is, will then folks say, if you can only do that, you have to do these things anything, and you can only do what's under the Forest Practices Act, shouldn't these other elements be in the Forest Practices Act?
Okay.
If I may, just one other point. The structure of the bill ultimately has amendment to the Forest Practices Act purpose statement and describes in that what sound management would be under management of the state forests. From a standpoint of keeping the Forest Practices Act doing what it's always been doing, we'd be much more comfortable if that was going to go forward, that element was in Chapter 530, the management of the state forest lands, rather than in Chapter 527, the Forest Practices Act. I think it would be just as effective there as it is and probably easier for folks to find and associate.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. Okay. I have two full pages.
Okay.
Here, I may break at a moment and take another bill because we have some people from Central Oregon here as well. But first, I'm going to take the people from the coast. Tim, Linda, and Helen. And let's see, we only have three chairs. I would love to have... Okay, and then next we'll have Howard from the Board of Forestry. My distance here. And we'll keep this hearing open as long as I can get everybody in that is from a distance. So if not, I'll ask people to wait until we can do some other bills and reopen it later if we go too long. Good afternoon. Hi, Tim.
Hi.
Would you who's going to go first? Would you put your name on the record? And
I'll be happy to.
Thank you.
Here's Clarno and Brown. And committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today on House Bill 3632. My name is Helen Westbrook. I'm the chairperson of the Clatsop County Board of Commissioners. The Clatsop Forest is the second largest in the state, and revenue from the county's 154,000 acres of forest land is extremely important to us. But the Clatsop County Board of Commissioners is on record in opposition to House Bill 3632. 3632 would demolish the Northwest Oregon State Forest Management Plan before we have a chance to see that plan at work. It would negate the six-year planning process, which represents a collaborative effort by parties with varied interests as well as the general public, to try to create a balance among the many values of the Clatsop and Tillamook State Forests. We believe that our forests represent great value beyond timber production and that our county will be best served in the long run by the balanced approach prescribed by the Forest Management Plan. We believe that there is significant economic value to be placed on the environmental and recreational aspects of the forest land. House Bill 3632 would remove the planning responsibilities for the forest from the Board of Forestry to the Oregon Legislature. Politics, not science, would drive management of the forests. The political pendulum will swing to and fro in the long-term goal of achieving greatest political permanent value for the citizens of the state could be lost. House Bill 3632 represents extremely short-term thinking when now, more than ever, our forests and our local governments need the benefit of long-term vision. The Clatsop County Commission asks you to vote no on House Bill 3632. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Helen. Any questions?
Yes. Commissioner Westbrook, how many folks on the Clatsop County Commission?
Five.
Unanimous?
4-1.
Thank you.
Who's going to go next?
I'll go next.
All right.
I'm Linda Madrell, Benton County Commissioner, co-chairs Clarno and Brown. It's nice to be here today and appreciate your time. Benton County is one of the County Forest Trust land counties, and as such, we support the work done by our board to develop and shape the structure-based management plan adopted by the Board of Forestry. This is a plan based on Oregon State University's work that achieves complex forest stands faster than nature would do left on its own, and it produces greater timber harvest over the long term than more aggressive early cutting. This plan considers the social, economic, and sustainable forest ecosystems and manages for the greatest permanent value. It is an active management plan that is directed at individualized implementation plans according to the nature of the site. This is a balanced approach that suits the owners of the forest, the public, and the public will see maintenance and restoration of habitat for fish and other wildlife, enhancement and maintenance of the soil, air and water, outdoor recreational opportunities, fire suppression, jobs, and revenue for the counties and the schools. We are certainly disappointed, probably not as much as Clatsop and Tillamook counties, who have a much larger financial stake than Benton County does in this, but we were really disappointed to learn that the harvest levels that we thought were going to occur just simply didn't make it. It turns out that the modeling done by OSU's College of Forestry used data that was useful in comparing a range of management scenarios, but to predict a specific output just wasn't in the cards. But that's not a reason to scrap the plan. It has not had an opportunity to work. Instead, we and the other counties agreed to contribute to the continuing work of a consultant to maximize the county's revenue while observing the shared values of the counties. There is no need for the legislature to scrap the existing management plan and replace it with one that would treat the state forests as if they were privately owned timberlands. This plan has been years in the making with a lot of public input. It is one of the multiple strategies that should be employed in managing the forests in this state under a variety of ownerships, including the industrial forest practices allowed in this bill. The state timberlands are different. They are owned by the people. We must not change the management of the forest to be managed primarily for timber without a balanced consideration of the other values. The bill cites that the leading use is the growing and harvesting of forest tree species and regulates the other values to a secondary status. The bill also directs the Board of Forestry to modify the forest management plans, including the modification or suspension of any other forest structure goals. This is inconsistent with the values of the Council of Forest Trust Lands and the public. Like all of the Forest Trust counties, Benton County would welcome increased jobs in the timber industry. In the past year, the county has eliminated 36 jobs, and we expect to lay off another 30 if our levy renewals fail in the fall. However, we must not be short-term thinkers reacting to the financial crises that affect each and every one of us today. These are not private timberlands. We must resist the well-intentioned efforts of those who support this bill and lift our heads from our current problems to look at the future of high-quality timber and predictable harvests on these forest lands. Thank you.
Thank you. Tim?
Thank you, Chair. Madam Speaker, I'm a bit of a graphics person, so I've got a handout, and I'd like to work you through that as I work along. But the first thing I'd like to do is
I need to have you say who you are.
Jim Jothi, chair of the Telemachanic Commission. Sorry about that.
Thank you.
And speaking of the chair, I need to tell you, first of all, Tillamook County has roughly 50% of the state forest lands in trust with the state. And I am the only, we have three county commissioners. The other two commissioners are in favor of this bill. So I'm in opposition to the bill. You need to know that. Now I would like to speak to you as the chair of the Forest Trust, or the vice chair, rather, of the Forest Trust Lands Advisory Council, and then the Council of Forest Trust Lands Counties. Virtually the same people in both organizations. One of them is a organization through AOC, and then the other one is actually statutorily based and is an advisory organization to the Board of Forestry and to the State Forester. Both organizations have taken a position that both entities oppose proposed legislation seeking changes to the state forest management plan. So you're going to hear people supporting this bill, but both organizations do not support this bill. Now I want to speak for myself. When I first became a county commissioner, I spent a lot of time in the development of the forest management plan and went to monthly meetings with the Department of Forestry personnel talking about all of the ramifications of the forest management plan, and it was very arduous and tedious working through that. But I can tell you I developed a real belief in the value of it. And the first page I wanted to show you, which I didn't, is the actual minutes from both organizations. You can look at those at your leisure. The next chart is actually, this is what the forest management plan is all about. This is structure-based management. This is a plan that's designed to emulate an older forest system. Through this plan, we're going to have five different stand arrays that will rotate across the landscape over time, and which will be good for substantial, sustainable timber harvest. And I'll talk a little bit more about that, Senator Brown, and try to get at your questions about where's the beef in this forest management plan. I think I can do that. But this is the dream. And this actually, I believe, was the brainchild of the ex-state forester, Jim Brown. He saw what happened with the state forest lands in Washington, and 50% of those lands are set aside. This doesn't set lands aside. This rotates land, and is designed to emulate an older forest system. Same thing I'd like to say is this bill takes policy away from the Board of Forestry and gives that role to the Oregon Legislature. And I think that this is a very dangerous precedent to be set. All we have to do is go to our federal forest lands and look what happened there when Congress got involved in forest policy. We went from about 5 billion board feet nationally a year to almost zero today. And I can tell you what happened in the 1990s because of the federal legislators getting involved in forest management policy at the national level. We lost 60,000 timber jobs in the 1990s. Half of those are gone for good. The others got jobs, but they got jobs in the service sector and low-paying jobs. We don't want to do that here in Oregon, and I believe this bill potentially sets us down that path. What happens with the next legislative body in Oregon, or the one after that, or the one after that, that wants to change the forest management plan and harvest goals? You don't know where it's going to lead us. I also am afraid that it would this bill, because it took 7 to 9 years to develop this forest management plan. We did it with lots of public input. We had over 20 independent scientists looking at this plan and making their comments. We did this very carefully, and we've created a legal umbrella that I'm afraid would be lost if this bill was passed. Now I want to get to the issues that Senator Brown was speaking to. I don't believe this bill is needed. The next graph that you look at is this one. It's a bar graph. If you look at the top two categories, almost 58,000 and a little over 61,000, that's the timber that's available in the Tillamook Forest, or not in the Tillamook District Forest. Now, I need to clarify that. The total acres in the Tillamook District Forest is a little over 250,000, but the Tillamook Forest actually goes into Washington County. So the Tillamook Forest takes in two separate districts. This is just the Tillamook District. We have almost 61,000 acres that's going to be harvested in this decade, and then what's left is the 61,027 acres that are available for harvest in the next decade. The next area, that little over 80, 37,000, those are acres unavailable for a number of reasons, and I'll talk about that in a minute. And then the next one, almost 21,000, those are acres unavailable due to economic constraints. And then finally, the salmon anchor habitat. Tillamook County salmon anchor habitat, you'll hear more about that today, I believe. It's about 90,000 acres. But don't let that fool you. What the actual acres that are unavailable for harvest is 23,233 acres. And the policy of salmon anchor habitat is, number one, it goes away in 10 years. Number two, there will be no net loss in harvest. So every tree that can't be cut down in this 23,000 acres is going to be cut up in the 57,931 acres. Now, if you could go to the next graph, the 87,336 acres. These are the acres that are not available for harvest, and there are a couple of major categories that the Trust Counties and State Department of Forestry is in contention over availability. And we have set up, well, let me talk about those first. The operationally limited, that's 16%, and in the aquatic riparian areas, there's some question about whether we ought to be able to go in there at least once and harvest. We've set up, when I say we, the Trust Counties have set up a work plan to address this issue, and it's in the implementation plan, and it's the next document. There are three pages, and it says on the bottom, draft implementation plan. It's no longer draft. It's been adopted by the state forester, and this is a document of the Department of Forestry, and so this details in great detail how we address these issues. There are a couple of work groups that are involved in that. I'm on one of them. We've hired a timber consultant, Mason Bruce and Gerard, Mark Rasmussen. He sits on one of these work groups. We're working through this process. When we get finished, we'll have a proper assessment of what's going to be out there, and then we will run another computer model, and we'll know what's actually there. We've agreed to that. The next diagram that I'd like to show you, I just got this today. This shows you, in for all of Tillamook County, this is the Tillamook Forest and the Tillamook District Forest and the Forest Grove District Forest. But this is the harvest that we're going to be seeing in Tillamook County and the revenues that we expect to receive. It's in terms of millions of board feet, we're at about 61 now. By 2006, we're going to be up to 133 million board feet. That's a dramatic climb. And what that is, that's an accelerated harvest of Swiss needle cast. And the one thing that I forgot to mention on the barrel graph, the 57,931 acres that is being harvested this decade, that is almost all Swiss needle cast. So the last graph that I'd like to show you is a document called Alternative 1C2. This was actually adopted by the Board of Forestry and accepted by the Trust Counties, and actually was the start of a lot of our problems, because we thought we would immediately see 279 million board feet a year. When the draft implementation plans came out, it would drop to 149. We've got them up to 175 now. We've got a work plan. We hope to get them up higher than that. But so we know that this document isn't correct, and it's not correct because it's based on a healthy forest. And but I think that the analysis that you have seen through legislative fiscal is also based on a healthy forest. All in all, I think, though, that this is correct. What you see here when we first get started is a dramatic increase in harvest where we're taking out the Swiss needle cast, and then it drops down where the trees go back. And then if you could look, and incidentally, this is decadal, so this is 200 years. What you will see with structure-based management is substantial, sustainable harvest forever, providing we don't get disease or our forest fire in there. And so we're going to be up right around 350 million board feet for the three northwest districts. And so I don't believe that this bill is needed for that reason. We're seeing a dramatic increase in the harvest in Tillamook County. It almost makes me think of the term, where's the beef? What's the purpose of this bill? And then finally, Charlie Stone talked about something that I'd like to talk about too, and that's the unintended impact of this bill. Basically, the last amendment or the last provision on this bill says, in essence, management of state forest trust land shall be achieved through compliance of the Forest Practices Act. Sort of puts a ceiling on what you can do. What this may end up doing is forcing a change in the Forest Practices Act. And I don't think any one of us want that. It may end up increasing the environmental standards on private forest lands, and that's not in anybody's interest. So I would like to conclude by saying that I think that through our efforts, we have developed a forest management plan that can be the model for the nation, including our federal forest lands. If we want to increase jobs, we have to show them show our federal foresters how to manage a forest, and it's just like our state forest management plan. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Any questions? Thank you. Senator Beyer.
Yes, I've got one comment. Tim, you said that when Congress got involved in federal timber harvest, the timber harvest went from 5 billion feet to almost none. I can't argue that the federal timber harvest has gone to almost none, but I would argue that it's not Congress that did that. It was the courts that have reduced our harvest to almost zero. Congress was mandating harvest levels. It's the court system who has changed that and said almost zero.
And if I could respond, it gets right back to my last comment, second to last comment. It's unintended impacts or effects of legislation by Congress. That was survey and manage. And what happened is it created a fiasco, and it created an opportunity for every timber sale to be contested in courts. And that's what I'm afraid we will do if this bill passes. Today...
Excuse me, Tim. Senator Beyer.
When the Congress got out of timber harvesting, it was called the Clinton Forest Plan, and the harvest level is still zero.
Okay, with that, I know, Tim, you can catch Senator Beyer later. I'm such a schedule here. Next, we have Mr. Sun from Roseburg, the Board of Forestry.
Okay.
And on deck will be Senator Hanneman, from Tillamook County Commissioner, and then I'm trying to get the people that have a distance to go here. After Paul Hanneman will be Rob Ferris from Ferris Lumber and Tina Swanson, who are come from a distance. Then I will try to, if we get another member back in here for a quorum, we'll go to some things we need to get done as executive appointments, etc., and then we'll go back to seeing what if we can get the rest of the people that have come from a distance, and then we'll go to House Bill 2617 because I have people then from a distance, and go back to work session on 3272, and then reopen this hearing. So that'll give you an idea of what we're going to do here. Good afternoon. If you'll put your name on the record, please.
Yes, my name is Howard Stone. Madam Chair and Committee, I'm glad for the opportunity to be here. I've served on the Board of Forestry for 7.5 years and currently serve as its chair. I am also a part owner and board chairman of a family timber company based in Roseburg called Lone Rock Timber Company. I just have a few points I'm going to make fairly briefly without repeating, I think, what lots of other people have said or will say. My first point is that the Board of Forestry has heard the legislature and believe we don't need this bill to get the job done. Let me explain a little bit. The Board of Forestry has listened and heard legislators who have concerns about the forest management plan for state forests in Northwest Oregon. The message from the legislature is loud and clear, and changes will be made. I believe the best way to make changes is to work within the existing forest management plan framework, and to do so through processes consistent with our practice of consulting scientific experts, and including all interested parties in deliberations. That's how we functioned in the past and how we need to function going forward. I do not believe we need this bill to get the job done. In fact, I'm concerned that the bill carries with it a number of liabilities and risks that we are all better off avoiding. One risk is the risk of political backlash. The bill would strengthen the case of those who want to shut down the state forest and further reduce its timber output. Another risk is that the bill would undermine the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds. The Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds is our best route to environmental protection and enhancement without more regulation. The third risk related to the Oregon Plan is increased exposure to the heavy hand of the federal government in enforcing the Endangered Species Act and the Clean Water Act, among others. And there are other risks as well, but I believe that these three, the risks of political backlash, the risk to the Oregon Salmon Plan, and the risk of a heavier hand from the federal government enforcing its laws are real risks that we face and could have adverse consequences for Oregon.
Howard, can I step you there and
yes.
go through each of those in a little bit more detail?
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming you're talking about in terms of political backlash that it's much more likely that an initiative would succeed should we pass this bill, an initiative to essentially lock up the forest or a portion of the forest.
Yes, I believe that's true.
Okay. And in terms of the Oregon Plan, can you talk to me about why this would potentially undermine the Oregon Plan?
Well, the Oregon Plan is a conservation plan for all of Oregon's forest. The northwest portion of the state is a critical component of that. It's a very important region of the state environmentally, particularly for fish species. When the federal government looks at how we're doing and what we're doing under the Oregon Plan and says, yeah, maybe that looks okay, they look very specifically at what we are doing on state lands, particularly in the Northwest Forest, because of the huge acreage of state lands in that region. So the standards that we have on that forest in the northwest part of the state are critical to keeping the federal agencies on board with the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds.
I think I would agree with you under a Clinton administration. I'm not sure I would agree with you under a Bush administration.
Well, the problem is it's not simply a matter of administration. It's a matter of law.
Okay.
And it's a matter of the federal agencies that are charged with enforcement of these laws.
Okay.
And they need to be with us on that.
And that's true as well as the Endangered Species and the Clean Water Act.
It is,
well.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Both of those are considerable constraints, which have not been referred to often in the context of this bill and its implications. But our constraints under federal laws are substantial, and the risks to harvest and revenue there are substantial as well. The second point I would make is that the Board of Forestry understands the economic concerns voiced in the legislature and has heard the call for more timber and revenue. There is potential for higher harvests than the volumes used in the 10-year implementation plans for the State Forest Management Plan, but I believe that the numbers on increased revenue and job creation that you have heard that have been provided to support the bill are overstated. Conditions in the economy and the industry are very different now than when the multipliers were developed in the 1990s. By multipliers, I mean those job factors per million board feet that you've heard about, how many jobs a million board feet of additional harvest might create. We're in very different circumstances now than we were when those multipliers were developed. In the context of overall harvest in Oregon, the increase envisioned in the bill on the state forests of the Northwest is small and will be absorbed by slack in the existing production infrastructure. Traditional employment multipliers are based on averages and overstate the impact of marginal increases in harvest. Efficiencies and excess capacity will absorb most of the increased volume without substantial additional employment. More points I'd like to make about that, but the only other thing I would say is that the strength of the economy and the demand for wood products, strength of the overall economy and demand for wood products, are larger factors in determining whether there will be new jobs in the wood products industry. The fact is that most of the economic and job advantage of increased harvests can be captured through the existing forest management plan by harvesting in the upper range of the estimates provided in the plan. And that is the goal of the board and the department, to harvest in that upper range. My third point is that the concern, the concern about higher management standards being applied to private lands is misplaced. You'll hear that concern expressed here today. You've heard it already. Some supporters of this bill argue that if the Forest Practices Act isn't good enough for state lands, soon it won't be good enough for private lands either. They believe more restrictive private land regulations will result if the forest management plan's higher will result from the forest management plan's higher standards for state lands. I believe the opposite is true, that higher standards on state lands and also on federal lands help support the Forest Practices Act standards on private lands. What matters from a habitat point of view is how the entire forest landscape is managed, not individual portions. But more important, the management standards in the forest management plan, if they are allowed to remain essentially in place, hold huge potential for increasing timber availability in Oregon long term. Rather than becoming the model for private lands, as some fear, and I don't, the forest management plan could become the model for managing other public lands in Oregon. 57% of Oregon's forest lands are federally owned, some 16 million acres. If the state forest management plan demonstrates the economic and environmental viability of managing lands this way, if it demonstrates through its innovative approach to structure-based management the compatibility of environmental goals and substantial harvest, a huge addition to supply could be unleashed on the federal forests. Talk about big contributions to Oregon's economy. Harvest prescriptions of the forest management plan applied to millions of acres versus a few hundred thousand. Getting too greedy about the Tillamook class of forests could put that potential in jeopardy. Finally, a note about sustainability. Management of state lands must be biologically, socially, and economically, and politically sustainable. All are essential to a policy with a shelf life long enough to be compatible with the length of life of forests. Biologically sustainable means managing so that the capacity of the forest to produce timber and wildlife habitat, along with recreation and other values, is not diminished over time. Economically sustainable means managing so that the revenue stream is sufficient to motivate investment, to meet the fiduciary responsibility of the counties, and to be consistent with the underlying capacity to produce products of commercial value. Politically sustainable, the point where I began, means retaining consistent, not pendulum swinging, public support. It means retaining consistent public support for management that includes substantial harvest. That's political sustainability. And that's how the Board of Forestry sees its responsibility for sustainable management of state forests. In conclusion, I've focused on just a few concerns, and I know there are others, including whether salmon anchor habitats are needed, whether the greatest permanent value rule has the balance of values right, whether counties have been fully part of the process at all stages. I know those are legitimate concerns. We understand the legislature's concerns. We believe those concerns can best be addressed within the existing forest management plan framework and existing statutes. We don't need this bill to accomplish these goals, and in fact, the board is very concerned, I'm very concerned, that the bill could become an obstacle to achieving these very goals over the long term. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sun. Any questions? Thank you very much. I will, Senator or Representative Hannon, I told you you'd be next, but I've got to close this public hearing on House Bill 3632 and open a work session on executive appointments. Senator Brown.
Madam Chair. I would move we approve the appointment of Phil Lang and Robert Rice to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission and David Kottkamp to the State Parks and Recreation Commission.
Senator Brown moves that we approve the executive appointment of Phil Lang to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission and Robert Rice as well, and also the State Parks and Recreation Commission appointment David Kottkamp. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, so moved. Senator Atkinson, would you like to carry those? Senator Atkinson will be the carrier of the appointments. Senator Brown.
Thank you. I assume we're in work session.
We are in work session.
Measure drafting and introduction request.
Of measure request.
I would move that the following measures be drafted and introduced by the Senate Rules Committee. Number one, from Legislative Advocates John Chandler's on SDCs. Number two, from Senator Brown on wastewater reuse. From Senator, number three, Senator Brown in farm dwellings and land zone for exclusive farm use. Number four, from the Oregon Association of Realtors on mineral rights. Number five, from Oxley and Associates on beverage containers. Number six, from Fred Van Natta on powers of semi-independent state agencies. Number seven, from the Public Affairs Council on mental health. And number eight, from Senator Corcoran on exempting translators from workers' compensation.
Senator Brown has moved the measure drafting requests 1 through 8 as listed. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, so moved. And now I will open a work session on House Bill 3272. Jim?
Madam Co-Chair, House Bill 3272A adjusts the boundaries of Linn County with its adjacent counties, Benton, Lane, Marion, and Polk. You have a conflict amendment to adopt with this if you wish to pass the bill. It's the dash A8 that was included in your packet. It resolves a conflict with House Bill 2676, which had to do with the boundary between Yamhill and Polk County.
Okay. We passed that bill?
That bill is, I think it's awaiting governor's signature. Yes, it's an enrolled bill.
We talked about
that. We are in work session on 3272. Has anyone had an opportunity to look at the amendments and willing to move those amendments?
Please, Sarah.
Go ahead. Senator Beyer.
Move the A8 amendments in the House Bill 3272.
They're
A8.
Yes.
A8. Sorry, I loaned mine out. Senator Beyer moves the dash A8 amendments to House Bill 3272. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, so moved. Senator Beyer?
And Chair, I move House Bill 3272 as amendment to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves House Bill 3272A as amended to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, so moved. Let's see. Who sponsored the bill? It's Representative Crook. Who would like to carry this bill?
Madam Chair, we've got me to carry the bill.
Senator Beyer would carry the bill. Thank you, Senator Beyer. Okay, close the work session on House Bill 3272. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2617A. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2617A. And it is my intent for those of you that are here to reopen the House Bill 3632 in a little bit.
Madam Co-Chair, House Bill 2617A authorized the cities in eastern and southern Oregon to amend urban growth boundaries to include certain sites for industrial and traded sector development. It has a sunset date of January 2nd, 2007.
Thank you, Jim. First, we have Doug Riggs and Oren Teeter. Please come forward.
I see that you have the dash six amendments also. I think that's in your packet.
The governor has two vetoes.
That's it.
Well, that's because he has the Senate. He didn't have the list.
That's right.
Good afternoon. Sorry for the wait. It's a busy day.
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Oren Teeter. I'm the mayor of the city of Bend. We greatly appreciate the committee's willingness to consider this legislation. As others have mentioned, House Bill 2617 is a result of a lengthy series of discussions that have been held with LCDC, local citizens, the council, League of Oregon Cities, and others. Our effort is not to undo the land use process. Our bill does not overturn Oregon's land use laws and does not prevent public involvement in decision-making process. That's important to us because, quite simply, I'm an elected official, too. Bend has gone through its share of growing pains, and we are stronger as a result. But one theme has emerged. We simply do not have any large parcels of land for industrial use. We have exactly zero 50-acre shovel-ready parcels. We're not alone. Other mayors and city officials I've spoken to in the past few weeks have said the same thing. Oregon is in short supply of market-ready industrial land. Our land use planning process allows us to add land from time to time. But our problem is the problem many of us are having. The current expansion process is both expensive and time-consuming. That's why this legislation is very important. It won't circumvent other major parts of land use process. It simply steps us past the first requirement, the needs analysis. This step alone might cost upwards to $350,000 and add 12 to 15 months to our efforts. In that end, after spending those tax dollars in that time, we then know exactly what we know now. Bend and other cities need large, contiguous parcels of land specifically for industrial development. What this bill does do is set up a pilot project. It's limited to 6 sites. It sunsets after 4 years. It covers only areas outside the Willamette Valley, and it will save cities and ours valuable time and tax dollars in the midst of economic crisis. We certainly appreciate the fact that some of those in Bend and others would like to preserve the current process, all of the current process. That process may have worked in the boom times, but is a challenge during this economic climate. The current process is cumbersome and expensive. What we're asking for is an opportunity to expedite the process and address very real, very urgent economic needs. This bill will not automatically bring in any property into Bend's UGB or any other city's UGB. Each local government will have to go through the Planning Commission, the County Commission, the City Council, LCDC. Opponents may still appeal our decisions to LUBA. But we will have the opportunity to secure local jobs and businesses in our community much sooner. This bill is good for the economic development. It's good for family wage jobs. And it will provide a fill in those middle wage earners gaps that we see in our community. It's a reasonable bill, and I urge you to vote for your help to our, excuse me, I urge you to vote to help your rural communities in providing jobs for our citizens.
Thank you, Oren. Appreciate your wait today. We've got a lot of people waiting, and I'm trying to decide what parts of this state are further from each other as I try to do this schedule. Doug, did you have something you want to say?
Yeah, Madam Chairman, I'll try to be quickly. Madam Chair. There's been an awful lot of debate on this bill in the last few weeks in the halls of this building. For the record, I'm Doug Riggs, representing the Central Oregon Cities Organization, which is Madras, Redmond, Bend, Sisters, Metolius, and Culver. There's been a lot of debate in the halls on this bill, and I think that the bill is actually more straightforward and reasonable than otherwise might have been misconstrued. Simply put, as we look at the bill, the goal is to help provide shovel or market-ready sites within UGBs in a shorter period of time in certain parts of the state. And the bill does this by allowing up to 6 local governments in a pilot project to accelerate their industrial UGB expansion process. It does so by having the legislature certify the need for industrial land, and this is part of the goals that LCDC and the state have enacted in their land use planning process. The first step of the process is certifying the need for industrial sites. We simply believe that the need exists for large industrial sites that are contiguous to the UGB, and therefore it's a self-evident question. Is there a need? Of course there's a need. The problem is that the current law requires communities, even in economic downtimes, to certify a need, which takes an extensive, time-consuming study that can cost cities of Bend upwards of $350,000. So what we've set up is a program that is a sunsetted program. It sunsets after January 1, 2006. It's limited to no more than 6 sites, and it's something that the Department of Land Conservation and Development suggested to us during a discussion on this subject several weeks ago. I think it's important to note that, as Oren said, that in spite of the fact that we're circumventing step one of the process, all other steps of the land use process remain in place. And so I have handed out a sheet for the committee to take a look at. It's a side-by-side of the existing land use process on the left and the process that would take place under 2617 on the right. And what you can see is that the only changes are in bold. And that would be a change in the first step of the process, which is the need to certify a need would no longer be required. LCDC down towards the bottom would still have to verify that we had complied with some of the sidebars that we put in the bill. And then the appeals could still take place, but it couldn't be appealable based on the justification of need since we've already certified need. But what you can see is that of the at least eight steps in this process, six of them remain absolutely unchanged. And one of them is changed only in a minor way. So I wanted to provide that for the committee.
Are the Dash 7 amendments yours, Doug?
Yes, they are.
Okay.
And they basically would replace the Dash 6 as they include two small changes suggested by DLCD made late yesterday afternoon. We were happy to
incorporate them. Will you go over the with the members of this committee the Dash 7 amendments yes. when you can? I have such a problem here with people that have come from the coast that I sure. need to move on. And if you would explain the Dash 7 amendments to the various senators on this panel.
Okay.
And then when we come back for work session, that will be helpful. Okay.
If I could just submit two other letters for the record. One letter is a letter from Bob Shiprack of the Oregon State Building Construction Trades Council expressing his strong support for the bill. The other is a letter from the Economic Development for Central Oregon organization, Roger Lee. I'd like to submit that for the record. And finally, I am going to provide for the committee a detailed list of the various changes that were requested by the governor's office or by LCDC. As you can see, they're fairly lengthy, and we have worked extensively to try to get the governor on board. Don't know yet whether or not he is on board, but we did want the committee to know that we spent quite a bit of time trying to incorporate his input.
Okay. Thank you, Doug. Thank you, Oren. Have a safe trip home. Senator Atkinson.
Mr. Riggs, Southern Oregon is defined in the bill, which would include Jackson, Josephine counties.
Correct. Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Brown.
Has Ben done a needs analysis already to show the need for more industrial land?
We are doing that right now, and we have completed that.
So it hasn't been completed?
Mm-hmm. We're in the process of
completing it.
Completing it right now through our planning department, our long-range planner.
Madam Chair, if I can answer the question, because I've spent quite a bit of time in the planning department. The needs study that Ben has done was based on LCDC regulations and requirements from 2.5 or 3 years ago, at a time when the economy was nowhere near as bad as it currently is. It was also based on direction that the planning staff had received from the council at the time, which was, I think it's fair to say, less friendly towards growth at the time. So the city believes that the city staff believes that to redo a needs analysis that would justify more than 227 acres to be brought into the UGB would require a new needs analysis study at the cost of several hundred thousand dollars or more. There are some people who will say, don't worry, you can do a needs analysis for less of a cost, and trust us, we will not appeal. We don't have faith that we can guarantee that people in the city, someone in the city of Bend or elsewhere, would not appeal that legitimately in saying that we had not done our homework. So as a result, that was the purpose. And when we were having discussions with DLCD, they said, yes, you would have to go back to the drawing board and do a new needs analysis, and that would take this amount of time. So how about exempting needs analysis for these limited duration pilot projects?
Thank you.
Madam Chair, just one other question.
Senator Brown?
Is there anything stopping Ben from expanding its urban growth boundary at this point in time?
With the minimum amount there is not.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Thanks again for coming over. I also have someone from Bend, Kate Kimball from Thousand Friends. Randy, you're signed up with her. Are you from Bend, too? You're not. I have someone on the other bill that's from the coast, and I need to get to them. So if I can have the distance people, if you have to go back to Bend, I'd have you now. And, Randy, I'll call on you later.
Hi, Kate.
Hi. Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. I am Kate Kimball, Central Oregon representative for 1,000 Friends of Oregon, and I live in Bend. Thousand Friends of Oregon is committed to protecting Oregon's productive farm and forest lands. We believe in the land use planning system, and that's why I'm here today. I appreciate you giving me this chance to come because I know you have other things to do and it's been a long day already. The reason I'm here is that one of the core values when cities expand their urban growth boundaries is how much do they expand it? It's the first question that always comes up in the areas I deal with. So showing need is really important. It shows that a city has done an inventory of the lands that are available. They've looked at their population and done calculations to see what kind of lands are needed for the 20-year planning period. And by showing need and really planning for this, we avoid sprawl, we avoid expensive extension of services such as roads and sewer, so that the taxpayers come out better, the city comes out better, and we have the nice cities that we enjoy in Oregon. Without this need demonstration, then we do promote more sprawl, and we set the precedent that need is not important in our land use planning system. And I think that would reverse a 30-year history of success in expanding urban growth boundaries. In addition, the bill sets a second set of rules for some players, and I know I cover three counties, and one of the things I hear over and over again is at least the rules are fair. Everybody understands what they are. They've been dealing with them for a while. By putting in a whole new system, I think that we cause unknown impacts on what happens with our urban growth boundaries. The situation in Bend, which I'm familiar with, last January the City Council decided to make expanding the urban growth boundary a priority, and in March they set out a timeline that, as of a meeting 6 weeks ago, they still adopted for finishing that process under the existing system by the end of the year. That system assumes that they will expand by about 200 to 300 acres. This is the economic land study that you've heard about. The economic land study that says that they need 200 to 300 acres of industrial land to meet future needs. It talks about large sites. It does a forecasting that's based on June 2001, so I think it's fairly current. And in my discussions with DLCD, that study would not need to be redone in order to expand the UGB. So the study shows that Bend needs about 200 acres for a 20-year supply of industrial lands. I believe this data shows that there's no emergency here. Bend has the ability to expand its UGB by the amount needed. Bend owns all of the land in discussion, so there's not a question of it being developed for other uses. Bend has a choice. It can expand for the 200 acres now and come back if they find that 20-year supply is used up more quickly than they expected, or they could plan for a longer planning horizon like the city of Redmond has done. Redmond's planning for a 50-year planning period, and that's over with the urban reserve system. In April, the Industrial Lands Task Force came to Bend, and I found that pretty interesting because I live in Central Oregon, so of course I'm worried about having livable wage jobs in our community. And at that briefing, they identified 12 shovel-ready sites, large shovel-ready sites that exist currently in Central Oregon that are waiting for industrial users, and those users have not shown up. That, I think, is the core of the industrial lands problem that we face today. At that briefing and at the other hearings minutes that I have read, none of these issues about avoiding doing the needs analysis has come up before the Industrial Lands Task Force. The study that supported that Industrial Lands Task Force found that the real problem with industrial lands is that we're not implementing the land use program as designed, and that would be the first priority. The other thing that I've noticed in Central Oregon, where all of the cities have expanded their urban growth boundaries or are in the process of doing so, is there has not been a case yet where the initial proposal was the final one. And the big difference is the public came in and they talked about it. They said, how much land do we need? Where is the land that people are considering? And in every case, I think there has been a substantial improvement in that process. And I think the planning commissioners and the elected officials would agree that public input has been important. Unfortunately, this legislation would silence the public on these key issues. How much land do you need and where is it? Those are the two most important. They're 80% of the issues in expanding an urban growth boundary. So while it might be only a couple of issues that are set aside, they are the key issues in how we expand our urban growth boundaries. I guess I would say as a Bend resident that we have a process underway in Bend, and I would respectfully ask that you let us finish that process. I know the planning staff in Bend, they do a good job, and I think we can finish this in a timely and cost-effective manner. Thank you.
Thank you, Kate. Any questions? Thank you very much. Have a safe trip home.
Thank you.
We'll close the... I have four more people to testify on this bill, but I have 14 on the other bills, so I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2617 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3632. And I would call first on, as I said before, Paul Hanneman and Rob and Tina, if you would come up, and Les, then you are number three. And I did get your note. I've got you in number three, and I'm sorry for the delay for you. Good afternoon, Representative Hannah.
Good afternoon, Senator Clarno and Senator Brown and members of the committee. Paul Hanneman, for the record, Cloverdale, Oregon. I have to say first that I believe that some of the opponents of 3632 did not make correct and accurate statements, and the chair of the Forest Trust Lands Advisory Committee, the commissioner from Polk County, is here. If you could possibly hear his brief remarks along the way, I think that he has an important message.
What's his name?
His name is Mike Probst, the Polk County Commission. And he is chair of the Forest Trust Lands Advisory Committee. There was reference made to that committee, and I think it was in error, and the position that it has. Thank you very much for hearing me. The good news is that I'll be very, very brief. I have a statement that I'll give to you, but I'll just paraphrase very quickly. There are only two major issues. One, on the one side, we have jobs, revenue, taxes, and the economy. That's already been talked to. The revenue statement is before you. You know the revenue impact of the bill, and its favorable impact on the state of Oregon, especially at this time. The other issue that has come up is protection of the environment if the bill passed. I was chair of the House Natural Resources Committee 30 years ago when the Forest Practices Act passed, and it was in my committee at that time. Since then, I've worked for Salmon Protections every year with all of my people and organizations along the Willamette, Columbia, and the Oregon coast. I take exception to people who say they either represent an organization and don't, or people who say that the bill, as it's currently amended in its A and gross form, will do some damage to the environment. What actually has happened here is that the Board of Forestry did adopt the Forest Management Plan, but afterwards adopted the implementation plans along with a salmon anchor program that included not the number of acres that you've heard, but 152,000 acres, and most of that in my county and Tillamook County alone. Some of that is, those acres are heavily impacted by restrictions, some only in a minor way. Even the press release that came out with the launch of this thing a few months ago clearly defined 152,000, and that doesn't include the entire basin. The actions by the board, which I have great respect for, Board of Forestry, and for the staff in the Department of Forestry, in this case, I think have overstepped, especially in this economic time, the need for the set-aside of some of these lands. What is truly unknown is what the forest is growing annually. We believe it's a low of 300 million board feet a year to a high of 500 million board feet a year. But a harvest is scarcely 25 to 30% of that. That's the question that needs to be answered. And also, exactly what type of harvest. I believe that the salmon anchors themselves do more damage to the forest management plan than the impact of the bill has on the plan. Those are my comments, and I truly believe that we are protecting water quality, wildlife, recreation, And all of the original purposes that this bill was intended, or that the whole plan for the forest was intended for, and that we can be confident in the passage of this, that we're protecting and preserving the forest. But to keep in mind that Tillamook County still owes $5.4 million in the original bonds to rehabilitate the forest. That's being deducted, or it will be in the future, from the $13 or $14 million original cost. Additionally, the department is trying to assess us, just our county alone, nearly $1.3 million in an accounting error that occurred in 1997. So we've got our bills to pay to, and we want to keep our people working in our their jobs in our mills and in the woods. And this bill meets the times and protects the environment at the same time. Thank you so much. I even said more than I really intended to in length. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
Madam Chair.
Senator Brown.
I want to follow up Commissioner Hanneman with on Senator or Mr. Stone's comments. He expressed concerns about political backlash that basically this will motivate the environmental community to move forward with initiative to lock up these two forests. And then secondly, his concerns about undermining the Oregon plan, particularly with regard to the and then obviously increasing our exposure with the Endangered Species Act and the Clean Water Act. Do you agree or disagree with those
disagree
comments?
Disagree with both on both counts. The Oregon plan is both into so well with our watershed councils, our soil and water conservation commissions, and our counties and our cities, and all of us working together. I'm speaking of the Oregon coast now. That there is where we meet the basic framework of the Oregon plan. And secondly, I'm sorry, your other point.
Political backlash.
Oh, the backlash. We're fairly certain that the initiative is going forward anyway, and would, whether or not the bill passes, whether it gives it any more headway or steam, I'm not sure. But I can tell you that we can, even though we don't have all of the inventory numbers and all of our data yet, we're doing that with our own money now. Tillamook County, Clatsop County isn't even helping us to pay for the research on that, as far as I know, with their last motion on their county commission, but we are. We're paying for that research along with several other counties, and we can show toe-to-toe, head-to-head with the initiative folks that we are right, that we're protecting the environment, that the forest is for everybody, and that we waited 50 years for the forest to mature where we could cut at least a portion of it over the next 30 years. And we can show that in a ballot measure, and we'll spend our last dime doing it.
Thank you, Paul. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Tina, would you like to go next?
Sure. First, I just wanted to thank the members of the committee for hearing my testimony today. My name is Tina Swanson, and I'm not only a employee of the Swanson Group, but I'm also a family member. Now, the Swanson Group is a family-owned and a family-run business in Glendale, Oregon. I'm here today not only on the behalf of the family, but also on behalf of all the employees that are employed at our business. Swanson Group was originally known as Superior Lumber Company, founded in Glendale, Oregon by my father and my uncle in 1951. Since then, we have founded a few other companies, including Swanson Superior Forest Products in 1973. And that was an interesting mill at the time. It was developed as a small log sawmill, something that wasn't, I guess, what a lot of the other mills were at the time in the day. And that's something that we've done to our other facility in Glendale, Oregon now. It's also been retooled as a small log sawmill, which would utilize second growth timber. Since its first day, Swanson Group has focused on meeting the housing and construction needs of a growing country. Our primary products are 2x4, 2x6 dimensional lumber, studs, and plywood products. Swanson Group has taken a leadership goal in ensuring the total and efficient use of forest resources. We use every single part of the log, including the bark, which is used for steam generation for our plywood plant. The company has obviously grown since its inception. I spoke to my dad about a month ago on the phone, asked him, when you began the company in 1951, how many employees did you have? And he said, I had 21. Today, Swanson Group employs over 600 people. 300 of those 600 people live in the Glendale-Azalea area, which is definitely rural Oregon. Another 100 live in the Grants Pass area. Our employees live in rural Oregon. What makes me very proud as an employee and a family member is the fact that we are able to supply those 600 people with living wages, something which is difficult to come by without college education in the city, much less in rural Oregon. In the late 1980s, it became apparent that for the Swanson Group to survive and excel into the future, it was going to have more control over its own timber supply. And to that end, we began purchasing some of our own ground. Today, we run and manage 140,000 acres of our own timberlands, and we use sustained forest practices, exceeding and meeting the requirements set forth in the Forest Practices Act, which you've heard mentioned many times today. We practice responsible reforestation. Last year, we planted over 1 million seedlings, and we plan to do the same again this year. That brings us to where Swanson Group obtains their raw material to run their facilities. We do have three facilities that produce lumber as well as a plywood and a veneer plant, and we obtain about only one-third of our needs from our own lands. The other third comes from open market purchases, which could range anything from a warehouse or timber sale to a small woodlands owner bringing in one load of logs. And the final third comes from state and federal timber program. So the state and federal timber program is not just a desire on our part or something that's nice to have. It's a necessity for us to continue to operate at the levels that we operate currently and to keep those 600 people employed. I feel that we can manage our forests for many different uses. In actively managing our lands, we can not only create timber for harvest, but improve the health and viability of our forests at the same time. Increasing the level of harvest off state lands and making that a priority is a true win-win situation. It will not only provide money for the state, it will provide homes for families and provide true living wages for employees of companies like ours. Thank you.
Thank you, Tina. Hello, Rob. Would you introduce yourself for the record?
My name is Robert Ferris, Jr., and I am with Ferris Lumber Company in Lyons, Oregon. Ours is a family-owned business. It was established 81 years ago, and we had about 100 employees in 1980, and we have 425 today. We've added about 100 in the last year. We don't have a large land base, and so we buy state timber sales, and they're very, very important to our survival. This bill to us is just a win-win-win. It provides the revenue you've heard about. It'll reduce the threat of catastrophic fire by thinning overly dense stands. The bill will add jobs and tax revenue and money, multiplying to rural communities that have been hard hit in the most recent recession. Environmentally, Senator, you asked Charlie Stone about what the effect on the ground would be. I think that timber cut on state land, on state timber sales, will be receive much greater scrutiny because you'll have timber sale administrators on the ground 3 days a week rather than on much smaller sales. There's maybe 100 timber sales a year from the state, and there are literally thousands and thousands of notices of operation across the state that they can't possibly get to. The department can't. So that is a positive from an environmental standpoint. And then also, the volume taken off the higher density state lands will result in fewer acres impacted across the landscape. And so that's another positive effect. I just think this is a jobs bill, an economic development bill. It's an environmentally responsible bill. It raises revenue. It creates tax dollars without raising taxes. And best of all, trees grow back. They're renewable. The broad bipartisan support that was found in the House reflects the legislature's understanding of the governor's inaugural message that we must rebuild our economy and create new jobs, opportunities for Oregon families, and that should be applauded and repeated in the Senate. The governor's spoken about the urban and rural divide in Oregon, and this bill provides an opportunity to end the differences between citizens across Oregon and do the right thing. It's capitalizing on Oregon's strengths financially.
Thank you, Rob. Any questions? Thank you both very much. And I know you shortened your testimony, which I appreciate very, very much. Thank you. Les, you've been patiently waiting. Les Helgeson from the Native Fish Society, come on up, please. And if you don't mind, Les, I'm going to ask if Bob Rees from the Coastal Fishing Guide would come up as well. And Tom Wolf from Trout Unlimited, if you would come up as well. These are folks that have checked that they live more than 100 miles, and we're trying to get them accommodate the distance traveled. Hi. Les, would you begin first, please?
Thank you, Senator Clarino, Senator Brown, co-chair, madam co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Les Helgeson from Beaver, Oregon, in Tillamook County. Glad to see two of my county commissioners are here today. I'm here as legislative coordinator for the Native Fish Society. I'm also on their board of directors. And we're a regional organization dedicated to the conservation of native fish and their habitat. This bill is of concern to us. Personally, my professional background consists of over 20 years as a contract botanist, forester, and nurseryman. So I have considerable experience in Western Oregon and the Coast Range in particular. And I think I'll, in order to be as brief as possible, I'd like to endorse the comments of the Board of Department of Forestry, particularly as it concerns the process here. I think we've gone through an extensive public process at considerable expense, which, if I'm not mistaken, was mandated by the legislature. So we've gone through that process, and I'll admit Native Fish Society isn't exactly happy with the outcome, but we recognize we've gone through a process, and we accept that. And for the record, we have not supported any legislation this session to modify that plan, much to the chagrin of some of our colleagues. But we believe this process is in place and should continue. This is an experimental plan. We need time to evaluate it. And I'm particularly, I'd like to particularly echo Mr. Sohn's concerns that the economic benefits have been overstated, and I would say grossly overstated. Just a year ago, the department let out a contract to begin inventorying the forest lands and particularly Tillamook State Forest, and they just let out this year, the second year of that contract, because they found they didn't know what resources they had and had discovered that the Swiss needle cast was much greater than had been earlier. Now, I can tell you, there is no cure. We have not developed a tree that is resistant to Swiss needle cast. You have to plant another species. That means hemlock, Sitka spruce, or in some cases hardwoods. In fact, some of the soils in the Tillamook are so deteriorated they will not grow conifers. They will only grow hardwoods due to the burns in the core area that was burned four times. That coupled with the steep slopes has created some significant problems. So when you factor in things like, we don't know the exact acreage yet of the Swiss needle cast damage, but we know that will accelerate the near-term harvest, which I suppose is good in terms of short-term economics. But your value of your hemlock and spruce is much lower than Douglas fir, and I think that's what some of our pseudo-foresters in the House Revenue Committee are failing to recognize. So in the long term, we're making a serious mistake here, and I'd ask that you not consider the bill any further and allow this plan that was developed with significant public input, allow this process to proceed. Thank you very much for the opportunity to comment.
Chair, good question. Senator Brown.
Thanks. You said that your organization is not supporting any legislation or opposing any legislation. Well, it's obviously opposing, but not supporting any legislation to change the management plan in place.
Right.
So my question is, if there is initiative on the ballot and this bill does not pass, what position is your organization likely to take?
We are currently neutral on the initiative.
We really haven't
made a decision to support. We're not currently supporting it, and we haven't made a decision whether to support or oppose it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. You want to go next?
Chair Clarno, Chair Brown, committee members. My name is Tom Wolf. I'm the chair of the 12th of the Travel Limited, Oregon Council of Travel Limited. I'm also chair of the Tualatin Watershed Council. Travel Limited has approximately 135,000 members nationally and 2,400 in the state, with 600 living within the confines of the Washington County that it would be affected by this bill. And I just want to briefly say that Travel Limited is opposed to this bill because, A, it takes away management decisions away from the Department of Forestry. B, it doesn't figure into account that public land is not only for your state forest land, particularly in Clatsop and Tillamook, is not only for harvest but also for recreation, protection of species that are such as salmon and other wildlife. And C, we just feel that the economic benefits stated by this bill are, as less stated, grossly overstated. And so thank you very much for this chance to testify before you.
Thank you, Tom, and thank you for your patience and waiting. Any questions? Bob, you're next. Whereabouts are you from the coast?
Tillamook, Oregon. I live in Bay City, actually, is my hometown.
Okay.
Thank you for the opportunity to, Madam Chair, Madam Co-Chair, and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to voice my concerns to you today. My name is Bob Reese, and I am a full-time fishing guide in the watersheds of the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forests, and as I mentioned, a resident of Bay City, Oregon. This is prime season for us right now, but due to a highly restricted sport fishery on the Columbia River, I have this opportunity to speak to you. And it is a sport fishing opportunity, or the lack of, that has brought me to Salem. This year, we will be privileged with one of the most liberal ocean coho seasons off the Oregon coast that we've seen in over a decade. This is due to a healthier return of wild coho to Oregon's coastal watersheds. The larger the return of wild coho our streams get, the more opportunity sport anglers receive in offshore fisheries. This equals huge revenue for the small coastal ports of the central and northern Oregon coast. These are dollars that go a long way in our current economic downturn, particularly in tourism. Tackle and bait shops, motels and gas stations, grocery stores and restaurants, and charter boats and fishing guides are just some of the businesses that benefit from the sport fishing boom. The dangers of introducing legislation such as House Bill 3632, which would significantly increase harvest in our state forest, is that it endangers the fragile coastal economies that once again are starting to realize the economic powerhouse that sport fishing provides to them. There's a lot of hard science that shows the correlation of large wood and its abundance to juvenile coho production in Oregon. If the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forests are allowed to be managed primarily for the purpose of timber harvest and not the broad spectrum of recreational opportunity, I ask, how will we explain this to our small coastal businesses that depend on tourism this time around? Are the thousands of commercial and sport fishers of Oregon expected to be dry docked for another decade or more? The Tillamook and Clatsop State Forests have value beyond timber production. Forest management should balance economic growth with environmental stewardship to benefit all Oregonians. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob. Any questions? Thank you very much for coming over from the coast and sharing your testimony. Thank you all.
Thank you,
Sorry for the long wait, you guys. Okay, next I have Mike Probst from Polk County. And also with Mike, since your position is the same, I'm going to ask Dave Ivanhoff and Ray Wilkinson to come up as well. I'm doing this one by your position on the bill, not your distance, but I have very few left that have a distance problem.
More fun to get at the same time.
Pardon me?
More fun to get
from
at the same time.
Senator Barr, yes, I'm sure there's a different way to do it than I'm doing.
Yeah, it would be funner if we had opposites up here, wouldn't it?
No, it wouldn't.
I don't think so. I think we'll continue doing it my way.
My word for it.
Thank you, Chairman.
You're welcome. Good afternoon.
I'm Mike Probst, Polk County Commissioner, and I'm chairman of the County Forest Trust Lands Committee and County Forest Advisory Committee. And I only, I actually wasn't going to testify for the County Forest Trust Land Advisory Board or Trust Land Committee, but since that was brought up earlier, I thought I'd better set the record straight. Commissioner Josie had said that those two committees had taken a position on this bill, and in fact that those two committees has not taken a position on this bill. The last time the committees met, this bill hadn't even been introduced, so it couldn't have taken a position on this particular bill. The position that was taken was that if there was a bill presented that supported forest timber harvest and production on state timber lands, that it would support bills that would do that. And that's what this bill does. So that portion of this bill, those committees actually support, contrary to what the commissioner had said. Now, the committee does support the timber, the forest management plan the state has. But as far as this bill, the committee has not taken a position against that. So I just wanted to make the record state clear. And that is very important because those are advisory boards through the Board of Forestry, and we are not in opposition to this bill. There is a portion of this bill that I think is very important that we did take a direct position in favor of, and that's the very first portion of this bill. That is a change, and that is in support of the harvest and production of timber as the primary purpose of the forest land. So that is very important. The other issue, though, is how do we get there? We have spent a lot of time working with the state on. Now, I'm leaving the testimony to clear up that issue, and I'm talking as myself and the time I've spent working on this forest management plan. And I've represented Polk County and have done a lot of work on this. I think 7 years, actually, to this point in time. We've spent a lot of time working on this forest management plan, and the counties have worked a tremendous amount of time, and we've came to a point where we were supporting the forest management plan that produced 279 million board feet of timber, which was a substantial amount of timber production on these lands. And we came to an agreement that we would support that plan because it did a lot of other things. It had a lot of protection for the environment. It had a lot of recreational protections, and it looked like a win-win for everybody. So to kind of sum it up, that's where we were. It looked like we had a win-win. Well, then the implementation plans for that came out from the state only produced 149 million board feet a year. That was far short of the forest management plan that the county signed on to. That was not acceptable to us. And at that point in time, we did hire a forester to work with us in the state to try to figure out how come those implementation plans were far short of what we agreed to. And he found some problems in the implementation plan and submitted those to the state. And they
worked on those and looked at those and accepted some of the issues that he brought up, and that brought it up to 179 million board feet. Or 176 million board feet, excuse me. Well, that still was far short of the 276 million that we signed on to as an acceptable plan to the counties. Well, the forester that we hired still felt there was an implementation plan that could bring that up to the 276 million board feet. But they felt, the state still felt that that couldn't be done, but we did. And just to kind of shorten this all up, the bill that has been submitted actually gets you to the number. So there's different ways you can get there, either through an implementation plan at these higher levels, or through a bill like this, or some way. But basically what you're looking at is there's ways that you can manage these forests for these type of revenues and the type of jobs you're looking at. And I guess what I'm getting at here is that we have forests in this state that can produce substantial revenues, and there's different ways to do it. This bill is one way to do it. The plan, the forest plan that the state has, if they would choose proper or choose implementation plans, they could do it. And it's a choice. Now, the choice is before the legislature. Which way do you want to go? And I think the legislature is a body to make the decisions for the state. And you've heard some things that, well, the legislature's not the proper one to set the choice, that it should be the forestry department managing it. Well, we have, I believe, probably the best Department of Forestry in the nation. But it is the legislative body that sets the guideline. And then under that guideline, the department manages under that. And the reason we're here now is because this department has done a fine job managing that forest, and now we have something to argue about. We have a good forest out there, but there has to be a policy set, and it's time to set that policy.
Okay.
And being a policy setter, I believe you're the board that needs to set that final policy.
I think you're preaching to the choir, but go ahead, that's fine.
Well, that's it.
Senator Byers raises trees, and I've been a former tree owner, so I think you're speaking to the choir, but some of the choir is missing here. Which one of you would like to go next?
I'll go next. Good afternoon, Chair Clarno and members of the committee. My name is Dave Ivanoff. I'm the Vice President of Resources for Hampton Affiliates, and in that capacity I'm responsible for the procurement of the raw material we need to run our sawmills in Willamina and Tillamook, and I'm also responsible for the management of about 155,000 acres of company-owned timberland. The forest management planning process on these lands began in 1994, and I was an active participant all through that process, participating in numerous public hearings, providing both oral and written testimony when appropriate to do so. The planning process culminated in January of 2001 when the Board of Forestry approved the forest management plan. In the board's intent statement relative to the management plan, it specifically stated that the department would implement strategies that would be in complete strategic and tactical alignment with the assumptions used in Dr. John Sessions' model, which was an economic model. The department retained Dr. Sessions to develop an economic model to illustrate the array of outputs under different strategies. The alternative One, option C2 model was the foundation of the forest management plan. And as you've heard earlier, Dr. Sessions modeled outputs from the three North Coast districts of 279 million feet. That's Astoria, Forest Grove, and Tillamook. Frankly, it was after 7 or 8 years of long process of participation, there was a sense of euphoria that we'd finally achieved a compromise. While I was not completely satisfied with the outputs of 279 million feet from these three North Coast districts, they were nevertheless a result of a compromise. These lands were capable of much higher outputs under conventional forest management, but nevertheless, I participated and agreed that this was an acceptable compromise of well-intentioned people participating over 7 or 8 years. In about 6 months after the plan was approved, the implementation plans first came out, and they were 134 million feet short of what Dr. Sessions modeled, and it was with absolute shock and dismay when I saw those numbers. And over the next couple of years, I participated along with others in workshops with the department trying to figure out how we could develop implementation plans that would more closely replicate the numbers Dr. Sessions modeled. And through that process, the department has now gotten the implementation plans up to 179 million feet off of those three North Coast districts. Again, I believe this 100 million board foot shortfall is due to the plans not being in complete strategic and tactical alignment. The department is working on an HCP. Embodied within the negotiations within the HCP are restrictions on harvest activities that are available and that were assumed by Dr. Sessions. I would like now to just turn your attention to the spreadsheet that I believe you now have in front of you. If I could turn your attention to bullet point 3 under the block issues relative to the Northwest Forest Management Plan. Again, this is just showing in tabular form what I'm talking about. Dr. Sessions' number of 279 million and the department's implementation plans of 179 million. That's a 100 million foot shortfall. Now the question is Dr. Sessions' numbers reasonable? Are they reasonable? And as a professional forester and other foresters that are involved in this would say that this 504,000 acres on these three North Coast districts should be putting on about 1,100 board feet per acre per year given the age class and stocking levels. If you discount that for the aquatic and riparian areas by 20% and then take another 25% discount for the effects of Swiss needle cast, the growth out there would show that the growth rate is about 333 million. If you go to item B under number 4 there, the low end of the inventory range that's out there on the landscape is 9 billion feet. And if you look at C, the high end of the range is 13 billion feet. It's probably somewhere in between those two numbers. But if you assume that on that recoverable merchantable inventory, a growth rate of 5% a year, which is conservative given the age classes and the stocking level and the site quality, and then discounting that by 25%, you can see that that would indicate a growth range of 338 million up to 488 million rounded. If you average those three numbers together, it shows 385 million feet on the landscape. And coincidentally, in the Department of Forestry's testimony in front of the Senate Agricultural Committee on April 11th, under their timber supply assessment, the department's documents show that these lands would be putting out 370 million feet under a conventional even-age model. So what it leads me to conclude is that not only is Dr. Sessions' number of 279 million feet reasonable, it should be easily achievable as well. Now, if I could draw your attention to the revenue impact block down here, this is the difference between this block and the one I had your attention focused on earlier. Is this is for all of the land under the consideration under the Northwest and Southwest Forest Management Plan. This is 634,000 acres. And I agree with the revenue impact statement. The difference between conventional management on that entire land base would be $397 million a year, and the mid-range outputs would be $218 million. The difference is 179 million feet. at a conservative stumpage rate of $300 a thousand, which was the fiscal 2002 average stumpage rate on the three North Coast districts. And that stumpage rate reflects predominantly commercial thinning. That stumpage rate will go up as you remove higher volumes per acre, which this bill would allow. The difference is, on an annual basis, almost $54 million a year in direct stumpage receipts, and the biennial impact is $107.4 million. Now, in summary form, these state timberlands are an incredibly important source of raw material that we need to support our Willamina and Tillamook sawmills. We employ 522 people with an annual payroll of over $29 million. Parts and repairs bring the economy about $9 million in additional business. As you've heard earlier today, these state lands comprise about 3% of the forested land base in this state. And while federal lands comprise 57% of the land base, those federal lands are providing predominantly the habitat needs for old growth dependent species. The incremental contribution for old growth dependent species on these state lands would be relatively minor at only 3% of the land base. But when you look at that attempt to create old growth stand characteristics on 50% of the land base, and that's what this structure-based management plan calls for, it comes at a huge impact in terms of both jobs and revenue to this state. And I would respectfully suggest that, contrary to what some of the other speakers have said today, this plan does not scrap the forest management plan. It's not necessary to throw out 7 or 8 years of public input and testimony. I believe that structure-based management can be used under this plan by allocating some of these older forest structures to the riparian areas, which can be harvested just as Dr. John Sessions assumed they would be, and that while you may not have 50% of the land base in old growth type characteristics, you could certainly have 20 to 25% of the land base in those characteristics and be generating the kind of revenue and timber outputs that Dr. Sessions' model assumed. I guess the other thing I'd like to address is the concern relative to the impact on whether or not this the passage of this bill would put at risk some of the other issues for private landowners. Chairman Sohn indicated that he believes that landowners would be given a free pass, if you will, if the state imposes aquatic and riparian standards that go far beyond the Forest Practices Act. Our company lost about $28.5 million of value on our timberland in the state of Oregon, in the state of Washington, when the forest and fish rules were passed. And basically, those were changes from forest practice standards that were put in place, in our view, for political science and not based on natural science. I believe that the private forest landowning community in this state is going to be standing vulnerable to the logical question of saying, if the Department of Forestry is managing with 170-foot buffers, then why aren't you? It seems to me that it's really a logical question to ask when we have the record runs of coho salmon returning now. Why do we need to set aside this much ground and take it out of production? The returning coho runs, in my view, are based on the improved ocean conditions. The aquatic and riparian strategies under the forest management plan have not been in place long enough to be the causal effect for this improved these improved salmon runs. So I guess it's a question that I would ask. I don't believe that there will be a political backlash if this bill passes. Ray Wilkerson will speak to a survey that we've recently conducted that will simply state that the public won't support an initiative. I don't believe the 4D process will be compromised, and I don't see any reason for the Oregon plan to be compromised by the passage of this bill. Again, through the proactive efforts of the forest landowning community, both public and private, we've spent a tremendous amount of money helping to restore the riparian ecosystems, and we're starting to see that the effects of that in the salmon plan. I guess with respect to Swiss Needlecast, I strongly submit that because of the fiduciary responsibility that exists to the trust counties, we need to get these non-productive lands converted to productive species, and I believe that this bill will allow that. I think in summary that this bill is a wonderful opportunity to restore the divide that exists between urban and rural Oregon. It will help restore the profession of forestry and bring back the backbone of this state that we lost, frankly. And I don't believe it's going to come at the expense of the environment or recreation. We can have all of it. So with that, I thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. Sorry you had to wait so long today. Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ray Wilkerson, Oregon Forest Industries Council. I think just about everything that's need to be said has been said about this, so I'll be real quick. We've been approached ever since January when the session began by a number of legislators asking us whether or not, in our view, that we're getting the outputs off of state forest land that we should be getting, and our answer is they're a lot less than they would be if they were managed by private industry, and so I think those kind of conversations is what ultimately resulted in this bill being introduced. And there's really two or three major reasons why those differences are so dramatic. One is the longer rotations that are required under the state forest management plan. Private land would harvest trees in that part of Oregon about on a 50-year cycle. When the trees get 50 years old, you harvest and you plant another crop. That's a financially optimal age, and if every year you delay harvest past that financially optimal age, that's an expensive choice that you can make if you want to, but you need to understand that that costs money. The second big ticket item is these protection zones, such as the buffer strips. Dave Ivanoff just mentioned 170-foot buffers on both sides of fish-bearing streams. That applies in the state's plan no matter how small the stream is. The Forest Practices Act varies based on stream size. The state's plan is, even if it's a 2-foot wide stream, it's got a couple of small fish in it, you've got 170-foot buffers. Now, I have yet to hear anybody, and this is about the sixth public hearing on this issue this session in various committees, I've yet to hear anybody explain why that's an appropriate standard to leave that big of a buffer on a stream that's only 2 or 3 feet wide. The third difference is the state is attempting to negotiate what they call a habitat conservation plan with the federal regulatory agencies under the Federal Endangered Species Act. That, again, is a policy choice. There's some conception that somehow these laws, like the Endangered Species Act, establish higher requirements for public lands like the state than it does for private lands. That's simply not the case. Their obligations under the Endangered Species Act are the same as private lands. Private landowners have looked at these habitat conservation plans as an option and have decided that's not a good business decision to make. So that's the kind of the third reason, and the add them all up, it results in these huge costs. Now, we've heard today from some witnesses that these projections are overstated, that jobs and the harvest levels and that sort of thing are overstated. I'd just like to make it clear, these are not some industry numbers. These are the state of Oregon's numbers. This is a Legislative Revenue Office fiscal impact statement on this bill developed by input from state agencies. So, you know, I think that's as close to objective information as you can get. The other reason we have a real strong interest in this bill is because of the implication that somehow what we're doing on our lands is inadequate through the Forest Practices Act, that this is somehow a minimal thing that's really somehow the state's got to make up for it by doing more because we're doing something wrong. We frankly disagree with that. The Forest Practices Act has got real teeth in it. It costs us $55 million a year in the value of timber left behind on our private lands to just comply with the minimal standards of the Forest Practices Act. That's not a weak law at all. That's a very strong law that we believe is adequately protecting the environment. If it's not, somebody needs to tell us what's wrong with it, and we'll fix it. If it is, there's no reason for the state to go beyond it, particularly at the enormous costs that are associated with we've seen with this bill. Finally, one last thing, Madam Chair. There's been a number of points made today that I think can be refuted by direct evidence, and they've just touched on a couple of them. That there's going to be some sort of political backlash, that the people of Oregon don't support this kind of legislation. You're likely to get an initiative that's likely to pass, lock up the whole forest. A statewide poll has been recently done that rejects that overwhelmingly. People of Oregon support this bill, and they would not, even if the legislature did increase timber harvest significantly on these lands through legislation, they would still not support an initiative, not even close. Another one is, well, if you do this, we're going to get sued. We've had our attorneys look at this, ask them the question, is there any way that the state of Oregon's legal exposure to litigation would be increased through the passage of this bill? The answer to that question is unequivocally no. There is no possibility of that. And finally, the process issue. You know, that somehow the legislature's got, it's not your business, that somehow the Board of Forestry are the experts, the State Department of Forestry is the experts, let them do it. Legislatures should stay out of it. We've got this plan. It's taken us 6 years. And just never mind is kind of the message. And we don't agree with that either. The legislature over the years has developed major forest policy legislation and has done a very good job of it that has stood the test of time and served the state of Oregon well, particularly in passing and repassing and revamping the Oregon Forest Practices Act numerous times, and they've gotten into the nitty-gritty of forest policy. They've made good decisions, and you've got another opportunity to do it with this bill, and we very much appreciate your consideration of it.
Thank you, Ray. Any questions? Thank you, gentlemen, very much. And next, we're still going by distance. We have Bob Van Dyke from Forest Grove. And Rick Turner from Newburgh, and Jeffrey Birmingham from Sierra Club, Seaside.
Man, you ran right out of the room.
Do any of those people I called? Oh, somebody's here. Then let's see, Brad Witt, would you come on up as well? And we have one more chair left. Okay, Mary Ann, you're here. And after Mary Ann, we'll have Sybil. I think it's Ackerman, is that correct? Okay. And Steve Cafori. So you're next. Okay. Hi, folks.
Hi.
Who's going to go first?
Ladies first.
I'd love to.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mary Ann Guest, representing the Tillamook Rainforest Coalition, and this is a group of over 115,000 Oregonians who oppose House Bill 3632. Many of our members come from coastal, they're small businesses from the coastal communities. House Bill 3632 emphasizes timber harvest over the landscape of the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forests. These forests represent 83% of our state forest, 83% of the state forest in Oregon. According to current law, these lands are to be managed for the greatest permanent value of the citizens of Oregon. You've heard it, this described as the Tillamook Burn area, and back then, it was in the 1930s and the 40s and 50s, there was a series of fires, and it was mostly industrial logging at that time, and after the Tillamook Burn occurred, there was just no use for the land, and so it in some cases was foreclosed to the counties, and the counties didn't have the money to do anything with it. They gave it to the state, and in 1973, Tom McCall designated it as the Tillamook State Forest. The House Revenue Committee, when they heard this bill, their total approach to the bill was as a revenue-raising measure. The discussion centered on unproduced potential in timber production in state forests, not on the science behind protection of water quality, salmon and wildlife, or the value of tourism and fishing, which can affect our economy. The question for the legislature is whether they believe our state forests are primarily for timber production. We think not. You just heard poll numbers. Well, we just did a poll too. 70% of Oregonians believe strongly that this is a special place and support a more balanced approach to managing our state forest. Oregonians reject turning our state forest into a tree farm. Even the former state forester, Jim Brown, when he testified in the House, said that the analysis that the timber industry used to justify changing the state forest into a tree farm was flawed, quote, flawed. Additionally, under House Bill 3632, the State Department of Forestry testified that there is risk of violating the Endangered Species Act. The bill lessens long-term protection and limits older forest structure. Now, we've heard that the bill creates 4,300 new jobs. If that was true, I'd be extremely excited. The fact is, while harvest levels from state forests doubled from 67 million board feet to 134 million board feet during the late 90s, according to the Oregon Labor Department, Tillamook County lumber and wood products manufacturing jobs hardly increased at all, rising by 12 jobs in 5 years. According to the same data set, jobs in forestry during the same period in Tillamook County actually shrank during the period from 89 jobs in 1995 to 85 in 2000. Now, here's a question I can't quite resolve in my mind, but today I read the paper and it has an article in Oregon about timber price or timber companies and what's happening in Oregon. And the quote was something to the fact that with timber prices right now, are at an all-time low, and there's a glut of products on the market, a glut of wood on the market. I'm not quite certain how that jives with what we're being told about the need for more lumber and more timber in Oregon. We understand the importance of creating jobs in Oregon. We believe that our natural assets are key to growing the economy and attracting new industry to Oregon. It's not by way of commercial timber harvest alone that forests support local economic vitality, but also by providing a broad range of valuable environmental services, watershed values, wildlife habitat, fisheries, recreational opportunities, scenic beauty, open space, and biodiversity. Quality of life is key to growing the Oregon's economy. We're not opposed to logging, but we are opposed to turning our state forest into a tree farm. The question is, and we've heard this forever, is a tree worth more alive or dead? And you know, the fact is, I don't know. And that'll be debated forever, I think. But the fact is that we do need balance between the economy and the environment in our state forest. We think House Bill 3632 goes too far. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mary Ann. Any questions? Senator Beyer.
Thank you. Could you share that newspaper article with me? Because you said timber prices are an all-time low.
Yeah.
According to that article.
Yeah.
That's just factually not true, so I'd like to see the article and see who wrote it.
Yeah. Thank you, Mary Ann. Bob, do you want to go next, or Brad?
Jeffrey? Brad's choice.
Oh, I thought I had Bob Van Dyke.
You did, but he left.
He left.
Oh, he left.
And you ended up with me.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Then do you want to go first, or Brad?
Brad's choice.
I'm happy to go, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Brad Witt, Secretary-Treasurer of the Oregon AFL-CIO. There are 180,000 AFL-CIO members in the state of Oregon. I am also a member of our state's Board of Forestry and have been for 7.5 years. I am not here today officially representing either the board or the department. I only share that information with you to give you a feel for my experience and perspective on this subject. And in the interest of brevity, I will attempt to summarize my prepared statement. House Bill 3632 replaces the Forest Management Plan with an economically driven timber production model. As time would allow later on, I would urge committee members to review my prepared statement and the comments I have on such topical matters as sustainability, adaptive management, greatest permanent value, structure-based management, and aquatic and riparian strategies, all of which are integral parts of a forest management plan. The FMP integrates the economic, social, and environmental expectations that the public told the Board of Forestry repeatedly that they wanted. Ad nauseum, they told us that. Yet it is being proposed by this bill to replace that integration. This contrasts markedly with House Bill 3632's advancement of economic values and outcomes over everything else. This primacy will create winners, and it will create losers among both human and natural communities. And losers, and I use that term not pejoratively, but only to characterize those folks who draw the short end of the straw, oftentimes resort to whatever means may be necessary to level the playing field. In this instance, court injunctions and ballot measures are available tools. Some might find them usable as weapons as well. We are currently into the second year of the Forest Management Plan's implementation phase. And Oregon has not experienced, the state of Oregon, has not experienced the kind of legal gridlock that has plagued our federal forests. And I suggest to you that it is in large part due to the Forest Management Plan's balanced treatment of social, economic, and environmental values. This has been the source of our success in avoiding those kinds of legal gridlocks on our state-owned forests. I urge you to permit this success to continue by rejecting House Bill 3632's well-intentioned on the part of many, yet misplaced economic focus. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brad. You were good to your word. You kept it brief, and you do have a very informative packet here, and it will go on the record, as well as Mr. Bob Van Dyke's testimony from Forest Grove, and I'm sorry we weren't able to hear him.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Jeffrey, would you like to go ahead?
Thank you. Lady Chair, members of the committee, I will be mercifully brief. Jeffrey Birmingham, Chair of the Sierra Club's Tillamook-Clatsop State Forest Committee. It appears that our society has become a drunk culture on quick fixes and easy solutions to long-term complex problems. We are regarded by other cultures as too focused upon the present and with no genuine regard for what we will evolve as a result of our self-serving myopic actions. It has been said that we are obsessed only upon the here and now. Our state natural resources have always been available to bail us out of temporary crises, but wisdom and forethought have always avoided this pitfall. The question you now consider is whether you shall be the leaders who sacrifice those long-standing resources to the temporal needs of today. I have learned that our state forests are already commodities, trees to be bought and sold. Although we profess to address forest values other than lumber production, anyone who has been paying attention knows the truth. If we as Oregonians were ever to pick a day when our state debated whether to relinquish its bountiful natural forest heritage, perhaps today is that day. So ask yourselves this question. When the forests are gone and the money for that squandered heritage is all spent, what is there that remains of a once proud and noble state? Thank you.
Thank you, Jeffrey. And have a safe trip home to Seaside.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Biden.
I guess I need to have you point out where in this article it says that, because I don't see that anywhere in the article that the timber prices are the lowest they've ever been in history. It does say that low prices and oversupply of increased competition have weighed down earnings of timber companies, but I don't see anywhere in the article where it says that timber prices are the lowest in the history. So if you could point that out to me after the hearing, I'd be happy to.
I'm sorry. That might have been my mistake. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Senator Barr.
I wasn't reading it when I said that.
Thank you, members of the panel, very much. Sybil Ackerman and Steve Gaffori. And Steve, I see you're signed up for the next bill, which I'm going to open momentarily. So if you'd like to stay up there after you're through with this one.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Gaffori. I'm here representing the Audubon Society of Portland. I want to thank you for your courtesy in staying so late, and both of you, and listening to all this testimony. Just like to introduce Sybil Ackerman, who is Conservation Director of the Audubon Society of Portland.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sybil Ackerman, Conservation Director of Audubon Society of Portland. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I do feel that a lot of issues have been brought up today. I have testimony that you can see there that's fairly detailed. What I'd like to do is be as brief as possible and hit the main points for you. First of all, the Audubon Society of Portland is celebrating its 100th year in Oregon. It's a vibrant organization with approximately 10,000 members who care about critical wildlife. So that's who I'm representing, and that's where my interests lie. The first sort of issue that I heard during the day that I actually didn't hear being brought up yet is the issue about the Forest Practices Act and also about the state law, ORS 530, and the differences and similarities. There was a rule that interpreted greatest permanent value that was very hard fought, that involved lots of testimony. I was personally involved in that in 1997-98. And I just wanted to read a quote from you for this state forest and to explain how different the current law is on state forests versus private lands and how it should stay that way. The board and state forest are not required to manage these lands to maximize revenue, exclude all non-revenue producing uses on these state forests, or produce revenue from every acre of these lands. That's OAR 629-035-00104. I just want to emphasize that this is something that this rule, and there's a lot of language in that rule interpreting it, but this rule is very important, and it involved all people from all different interests, and it was a very hard-fought compromise. There's good language in there, and there's language in there that the Audubon Society of Portland feels should be better, so it was obviously a compromise. The other piece I just wanted to reiterate, and it's been brought up numerous occasions, and that is the jobs question. And there was a report that was issued by Philip Reuter and Thomas Power, two economists who know way more than I do about economics, since my background is more in law. And one thing that they talked about was they really mirrored what Howard Sohn said about the fact that really ODF's numbers to interpret jobs is a little bit off now. And so the 4,300 new jobs is a little bit, could easily be interpreted as too high. One example that hasn't been mentioned yet is that the Tillamook County Lumber and Wood Products jobs covered by unemployment insurance went from 536 in 1995 to 548 in 2000. That's not a very big leap. And it shows that really the jobs, even though the timber was increased significantly between 1995 and 2000, the logging on the state forest, the people who were out of work in Tillamook County, it didn't decrease significantly. So it's a little bit questionable about exactly what the impact is going to be if this bill, HB 3630, is passed. The other question that's been brought up is there going to be controversy if this bill is passed? I would argue yes. It's not chance, and it's not simply ignore a fact that the environmental organizations have been ignoring the state forests, that there have been no lawsuits filed by environmental organizations on state forests. If this law passes, it could easily happen that there are lawsuits on state forests. There is currently a lawsuit that Audubon Society of Portland is involved in on private lands, involving whether private land is involving take of coho under the Endangered Species Act. I would argue that there would be some even more broad-reaching challenges on state forests if it was changed into purely a Forest Practices Act managed regime. And I think that's a very serious thing. The other issue, of course, is the initiative, but that was already brought up before. So those are the main things that I wanted to bring up. I had a whole long list of little pieces, but thank you so much for your time. And at this late hour, those will be the main points, and then my testimony on the record should give you the rest.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for being brief. I appreciate it very much. I'll close the public hearing on 3632 and open a public hearing on 2617. And I have Randy Tucker from Thousand Friends, Linda Ludwig, I hope I haven't pronounced that wrong, and Bob Rindy from DLCD on 2617.
None of them are here.
Well, Steve is here. Where'd he go?
He just headed out.
Oh, he's back. Has everyone left? Do you want to testify on it?
As long as I'm here, I'm here.
Okay.
I am Stephen Cafori. I'm here representing the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association. Obviously, I'd like to get out of here as much as you will, so I'm going to say that our organization opposes the bill. The land use planning system, which was established in 1973 and been developed ever since, has a number of sound planning principles which what follows. One is that there's an analysis of a factual situation first, an examination of options first, an involvement of citizens and interest groups first before decisions are made. What this bill does is turn that process on its ear, and it says the decisions are going to be made first, and then we'll go back and take a look at the analysis to see what the facts are and what the options are. we oppose the bill. We don't think it makes good sound land use planning process. Our folks are involved in process. That's what they do for a living. That's what they're trained in. We are supporting a bill, House Bill 2912, which Mr. Chandler is bringing forth, that you may be familiar with, which is asking for a four-year-long review of the land use planning process in the state. We think if there are problems in the way the processes are being carried out, that we ought to review those in a systematic manner, and we ought to make those decisions statewide, make those applications statewide, not on an ad hoc basis where somebody comes and says, I got a problem in my community. If Ben has a problem, then we got to take that problem up statewide, not just take care of Ben and nobody and no one else. That's my testimony. Thank you.
Appreciate you being brief, although I'm not so sure. We got to take care of Ben. I'd like to publicly thank Senator Beyer for hanging in there with me. It's been a long day. Next time we'll take a look at Jenna, thank you for being our staff person today. And Jan, thank you for filling in for Jim so we could get some work done. Thank you all very much, and we are adjourned. Next time we'll...